My mum, who then went to work in television, was running a drama group in Nottingham. Right. Who supplied all of the children as the supporting artists.
Sorry, supplying the children just sounds wrong.
Just your mum there with a fag end at her mouth. Do you want some kids? I'll get you some kids.
You've met my mum.
Yes. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that opens up the front door, pops its hat on the hat stand, says, "Hey honey, we're home," only to discover that the wife has left with the kids and the next door neighbour, and that you're in a shell of a house and a shell of a life, whilst the studio audience fails to see what is funny about any of it at all.
Comedy podcast,
yeah. I am your host, Ben Vanderveld, and with me is your other host, Barry McStay.
Hi, that was a really uplifting beginning to the episode, but I can see what you're driving at.
Yeah, you will see what I'm driving at as well. It's hard to keep things uplifting in these dark days.
It is, but we're going to do our best through the power of trivia.
Yeah.
The most potent force known to man.
Yeah, was that the sixth superhero in Captain Planet?
Yeah. Earth, fire, wind, water, heart, trivia. Yeah. he got one of those plastic rings you used to get in Christmas crackers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, our guest this week is a writer and director of theatre, TV and film. As a writer, he has authored and directed the brilliant plays The Act, which transferred to the West End, and Outings, which has toured the UK. As a director, he worked on the National Theatre's original smash hit production of The History Boys. He's worked with the Royal Court, the Globe, and the West End. And on screen, he directed David Mitchell, Miles Jupp and me in a short film called The Dark Room. He's recently directed his first episode of EastEnders, so from the West End all the way to the East End, moving down in the world, it's Mr. Thomas Heskett. From west to east.
Moving down in the world, hello.
Oh, my pet. No, I just mean in terms of the property market.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, okay. Was it the Pet Shop Boys? Did they write that song about you?
What, EastEnders?
Yeah, that's about me.
Yeah.
Very autobiographical.
So, we're very delighted to have you on the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
Before we get into what our topic is, we want to ask you, as we always do, I guess, what you are the worst at in the world.
I have so many things. But
it's amazing how many of our guests say that. I feel it's nearly like performers and people in the theatrical world are self-deprecating.
I've got a slightly different theory. I don't yet think we've had a North American guest on the show yet.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, lots of British people just going, well, I'm just awful at everything.
I'm just bad at life. I was thinking about it, and because there's so many things that I could say, like I was going to say time management. I thought, well, no, because I'm really good at time management when I want to be. As long as Friends isn't on television, then I'm bad at time management.
The late 90s, early noughties was a dark period.
Yes.
and then the last 8 years on E4, it was always on TV.
As long as I don't put on UK TV Gold, yeah, or whatever it's on, I'm fine. I was trying to think of something that I am just never good at, as opposed to something I'm sometimes good at, and I'm going to go with Latin. I'm terrible at Latin. I'm the worst at Latin.
Oh, that's really embarrassing because we were going to open up with some declensions.
Why?
Why am I bad at Latin?
Yes, and why? I mean, do you get looked down on in the country club or?
the other month, I was out with my old Latin teacher,
right?
As you do.
Yes.
Are we in an Evelyn Waugh novel all of a sudden?
Does get like that when I turn up.
I do have to fess up. I did also study Latin in school, so you're not alone.
Three for three.
Oh god. Well, good.
You were just trying to make it sound cooler, like.
Yeah, we just haven't kept in touch with our Latin teachers, like.
Well, is it because that the way that EastEnders is plotted, it's actually translated from the original Latin,
yeah,
that Terence wrote it in.
There was a Radio 4 documentary that traced all of the soap's storylines back to the original Greek tragedies.
Of course it was. The most BBC Radio 4 show ever.
Does that mean, like, Euripides is full of lines like, "Leave it, you slag!"
If you translate it...
So you were out with your Latin teacher.
I was out with my Latin teacher, and
threw a third declension and I neutered noun at you.
Well, I said, "Oh, this reminds me of when I was at school learning Latin with you." And he looked at me and said, well, you attended some of my lessons, Tom, but I don't think we could be so bold as to say that you learned anything in them. And I thought, yeah, fair enough.
Nice.
Although he did show us up Pompeii and introduce us to French cinema. So I feel that I learned a lot there, just not Latin.
Yes, our Friday Latin lessons involved watching I, Claudius, which was... made everything worthwhile.
Which is very similar to what Pompeii.
Yeah, very much. Is Biggins in both of them? Christopher Biggins is very much the archetypal Nero.
Well, the Romans didn't like camp. That was all the Greeks. Very broad brushstroke, historical brushstrokes yeah. there.
And you're referring it to a Frankie Howard comedy yeah, yeah. film, which I don't think was based on fact.
In the 100 years' time, Frankie Howard's of Pompeii is going to be our their generation's version of the decline and fall.
Now, whilst, Tom, you're not allowed to slag off EastEnders, don't worry, because there is going to be a lot of slagging off of television programmes coming up.
Good.
Because this week's subject is the worst TV comedy in history. In this, I think we could record all day and still not get close.
Yeah.
But we're not going to do that. We're going to try and keep it concise. And we're going to start with you, Barry. What have you uncovered?
There is a Wikipedia page called TV Shows That Are Considered the Worst, which is one of my favourite. Every now and again, I'll wander onto it, randomly click on one, and then YouTube clips from whatever the TV show is.
Is it a bit like jumpingtheshark.com?
It's similar.
Which is my favourite website ever. I think when I discovered that, I discovered the internet.
Yeah. It's when the internet is at its best.
Yeah.
It's when it's ripping the piss out of artistic endeavours.
Well, it was also where I learned what Jumping the Shark meant and could trace it back to the exact Happy Days episode then could then go and find that Happy Days episode, and now you see why I have a time management problem.
I've not watched that, so that episode, what I mostly care about is what level of shark is there. Is it better or worse than Jaws?
It's definitely pre-Jaws, I think.
It's pre-Jaws, and it's more that Fonz can now do things that are superhuman.
Yeah. So for anyone who doesn't know, the phrase jumping the shark means when a TV show has sort of gone off the deep end and really passed its... it's gone too far with the storyline or with its plotting. And there's an episode of Happy Days where the Fonz, I think it's for a bet, water skis over a shark. It's really bad. It's really bad.
And Happy Days was... before that one, Happy Days was, like, quality.
Yeah, it's... Couldn't keep a straight face. This Wikipedia page is similar in style to that. Some of my favourite things to look at are sitcoms that are sort of based on other sitcoms or that are spin-offs. Some of the best worst things are things like Joey, which came after Friends.
Oh, God, yeah. I couldn't bring myself to watch it.
Yeah, or Aftermath, which is set in a veterans hospital with three of the not famous original cast members of MASH.
What I love about that is they couldn't even be bothered with a title.
Yeah.
Just like, it's a bit like MASH, but not really.
Did it have a tie-in product placement? So, the, like, instead of After Eight, you could have After MASH, which was just more Smash.
Smash, yeah.
Yeah, mint-flavoured Smash.
But my, I discovered one of these, a sort of a, not a direct spin-off, but one that is the most obvious rip-off of Cheers. Cheers, obviously massively successful in the 80s, and did actually spawn a successful sitcom in Frasier.
Yep.
The executive producer of Cheers, a guy called Rob Long, also is the executive producer of a more recent sitcom called Sullivan and Son, which was on TBS, which is set in a bar.
Great.
And where everybody knows everybody, and it's kind of the courthouse and city hall of this town that it's in. Do you see a little pattern here, viewers? And it stars Brian Doyle Murray. Bill Murray's older brother. Another thing I love in some terrible shows is when it's a relative of a more famous and better comedy performer.
Oh my God, there's an amazing one. It's an amazing listicle, but it's basically showing siblings of famous people who just look like bad copies of them. And the saddest one is Brad Pitt's brother.
Oh no.
Who, if Brad Pitt didn't exist, you'd look at him and go, oh, you're a pretty decent looking guy, I bet you're kind of talented. But since you know that Brad Pitt exists, you just go, oh, what's wrong with you? Oh, you vile mutant of a man.
And there's a website with this on.
Yes.
I like the idea that sitcom producers go onto that website to cast now. When you can't get Brad
Pitt.
We can't get
Bill Murray. You get Brian Doyle Murray. I also love terrible shows where there's a random animal in it. Such as 1972 sitcom in America again, Me and the Chimp.
Oh, no.
First episode, suburban dentist child brings home a chimp, and they spend the remaining 20 or 30 episodes of the series having hilarious adventures based on the chimp's mishaps.
Who played the chimp?
It was very much a chimp called Buttons. Basically, the comedy seems to consist of Ted Bessel, who plays the lead character, arguing with the chimp constantly like it's a human being. The chimp turning on and off light switches and him telling, "No, I told you not to do that, chimp." Except he doesn't call it, he consistently calls it a monkey, which really pisses me off. Just like, it's annoying to the extent to which he goes, "Don't worry, it's just a monkey." And he goes, "It's not, it's an ape. It's a, get that right." But my favourite...
I love that to the bit. That's,
I mean, if you're gonna write a sitcom with an animal in it, get it right. My favourite thing about it is when I was reading the Wikipedia article about it. It gives you little summaries, one sentence summaries of episodes of it. And my favourite is an episode where the summary is, "Buttons helps Mike cure a small case of bigotry at the local country club."
Oh my...
Just a small, minor outbreak of bigotry.
I really hope the light isn't, that's not an ape, yeah, this is an ape.
That is exactly what I'm worried about. I've another couple I need to talk to you about. Imagine a sitcom set in the parochial house of some Irish Roman Catholic priests.
Of course.
Yeah.
Great.
There's an older one and a younger one. The younger one's meant to be slightly trendier, and the older one is always worried about the bishop moving him to a new parish. And they have a hilarious housekeeper who always makes them tea. Now imagine 10 years previously, the same sitcom. Yeah, it's not Father Ted. It's called Leave It to Mrs. O'Brien. And it was made by RTE, the company that turned down the chance to make Father Ted. Written by a Dublin housewife who is so unknown that she doesn't have a Wikipedia page.
Wow.
That's unknown.
Yeah. That's a real modern version of anonymity.
Yeah.
Doesn't have Wikipedia.
I love, you know, those TV programs about people trying to truly get off grid, and you'd be like, right, I've got rid of my Twitter, I've got rid of my Facebook, I just can't get rid of Wikipedia. Yeah. It's like an STD that clings on forever.
For the first series, they had no laughter track. For the second series, they introduced a studio audience. The article I read had the sentence, "The quantity of laughter generated was about the same."
Oh, that's so brutal.
Do you think they saw it when they wrote Father Ted?
I wonder if they did. I do want to sort of find that out, because it.
I can't remember the writer of Father
Greg
Ted.
Greg Lenehan and Martha Matthews. Yeah. They would have been in Ireland at the time, and it did get quite a large viewership. Got about 250,000 people watching it, which is a big audience in Ireland.
That's all of Ireland.
That's basically all of the people who had televisions back then. RTE said it was aimed at less discerning viewers, like children and the elderly. And so it didn't need to reach a standard above the low bar it was already hitting. But my number one pick for the worst sitcom of all time is called My Mother the Car. Oh my god, guys, if you haven't seen My Mother the Car, there are episodes online. Holy shit, this is awful. This is batshit crazy 1950s American sitcom heaven. In fact, I should be correct myself, it's 1965. Stars Jerry Van Dyke.
Who's Jerry Van Dyke?
He's Dick Van Dyke's younger brother.
Right.
Of course. From the same website.
Yeah, from the same website. He plays David Crabtree, a lawyer living in America. Now, the team on the show included Alan Burns, who produced The Munsters, he worked on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Get Smart, so lots of big hit shows. James L. Brooks, one of his first jobs on TV, was as a writer on the show, who's now executive producer of The Simpsons. So David's mother has died previously to the series, and in episode one, he buys a 1928 Porter, beautiful red vintage car, which he discovers that his dead mother has reincarnated herself into.
Yes! Well, I've heard of this. When you say reincarnated herself into the fabric, into the engine...
She is the car.
She is, sure.
The whole car.
The music to the show... has a best of all, it's got a very catchy theme tune, which basically explains the sitcom, which I love. It has lyrics on the screen, and one of those sing-along bouncy balls bouncing on top of the lyrics if you want to sing along.
This is making it good, not bad.
You wait. The lyrics include, "Believe it or not, my mother dear decided to come back as a car." That's it, like, she decided to be reincarnated as a car.
Well, like, you've got options. If I was going to be reincarnated and had a choice in it, and I was a woman and I was someone's mother, I wouldn't want to be reincarnated as a car that my son would then sit inside.
Oh my god, there's so many jokes and innuendos about that I don't know if they're even aware of. Okay. First of all, the idea that he's getting inside her and taking her for a spin is so Oedipal. There's an episode.
Can I ask what car? Because that would affect my choices. It's about whether I want to be a car.
It's a 1928 Porter, so it's red, it's sort of vintage open top.
No, okay, yeah. I mean, like, I can see why you... I'm not a car person, but I can see why that car would be something I could aspire to.
Yeah, yeah.
Hang on, so she's been reincarnated as a topless car?
Yes, his mother is a topless. She speaks... They basically have an animated dashboard of the thing, the radio thing sort of lights up and she speaks to him.
A little bit Knight Rider-y.
Yeah, and he's the only one who knows, so he spends a lot of his time sort of cleaning her and...
is there a... Oh, you've missed a bit. Oh, keep rubbing there. Keep rubbing there.
So episode two is an episode where there's some vandals and carjackers in the neighbourhood, so he gets a bit paranoid about wanting to look after her, doesn't want her stolen. So he eventually goes down and sleeps in the car. Then his wife and the kids and the dog join him because they all can't sleep and they don't know why he's down in the garage. So they're all inside the car. And his neighbour comes around and checks on him because he sees all of them in the bedroom.
Does anyone else know that the car is...
Not at this point. They find out towards the end of the series, yeah. And then in the morning, the car says to him, his mother says to him, "It sure was nice having the whole family sleep with me. Even Moon..." That's the dog. Oh, God. And my biggest beef with this, apart from the fact that it's the most ridiculous concept, and this is the era when they had like things like I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched, where there was all sorts of slightly weird supernatural things in sitcoms. This is a whole other level of weird.
Yeah.
They could be so much better if she wasn't a car. I'm gonna read you out the one sentence descriptions from Wikipedia, and just imagine that this woman is a woman and not a car. Dave and his mother tried to thwart the assassination of a visiting dignitary.
Great,
much better if it's a woman rather than a car. That's a woman in her 80s.
Do you think in the writers' room they were kept going, "Guys, you know, there's just one plot thing we want to change"? No, you bet. Yeah. It has to be a car.
No, she's a car. No, we've got the title. It's My Mother the Car. It would be weird if she wasn't a car.
Can you call it My Dead Mother? No. Mother the Car.
Another episode. David is forced to drive his mother to a mountaintop wedding, but along the way she gets drunk on antifreeze.
Wow, so that's a with nail and eye episode.
And my favourite one, I mean, I just wish they would remake this with her as an 80-year-old rather than a car. So the kids are called Cindy and Randy. Mother leads Cindy and Randy to believe that she's a genie who makes wishes come true when they rub her with a magic cloth. The Crabtree kids are soon charging other youngsters to rub and make a wish. Mother is basking in the attention, but Dave wants it to stop immediately.
Oh, God, that's so weird.
I have a question. So from the opening credits,
yeah,
it seems like being reincarnated as whatever you choose is a normal thing that everyone can do in this world that they have created.
Yes.
So surely there should be a supporting cast of other reincarnated inanimate objects.
Yeah, I would have liked
that. It should be like Beauty and the Beast. Yeah. Because it hasn't set it up that this is an unusual thing to do.
Yeah, and it's weird in 1960s America that reincarnation is a kind of a thing, when you'd have thought they'd have been big on what a more sort of straight down the line biblical doctrine.
What, so his mother has gone to hell where she is being a car ridden around by other demons?
Sure, yeah.
How many episodes did yours run to?
Ooh, 20, I think-ish. Nah, sort of typical American sitcom length.
So mine, I only have one. Mm-hmm. Because it's the definitive worst sitcom in the world. And I love it because I actually just genuinely love this. And I'm also one of the few people in this country who has seen every single episode.
Oh, wow.
Because that's physically impossible for most people. And I love it because it's such a spectacular failure. And when you're celebrating failure, it's such a... The reasons it failed are just fantastic.
Good. We like these.
So this was... this came out in February 1987 and was ITV's biggest sitcom of the year, biggest TV programme, going out 8:30 in the evening. It was directed by John Stroud, who went on to direct things like My Hero, Harry Enfield, Game On, proper sitcom royalty, died quite recently. Produced by Paula Birch, who went on to produce Outside Edge. Its cast included Roy Kinnear, in fact, was tragically virtually the last thing he did before he was killed. Roger Sloman, Granville Saxon, Duncan Preston, Pam Ferris.
Wow.
The guys who wrote it also worked on the comedy strip. It was Richard Hall and Simon Wright. They did things like comedy strip and stuff like that.
You think, how could this fail?
And they did. This was the most trailed show on ITV. It was on the front of the Radio Times. It was on front of the TV Times, and it was, yeah, it was going to be huge. It had, it was basically St. Trinian's meets the Young Ones. Right. It was buying into that kind of idea of alternative comedy. Rick Mail and Aidan Edmondson came and did a guest appearance on one of the later episodes. Yeah. They shot 7 episodes. The first one was an hour-long special to launch it on the Tuesday, and then they immediately followed up with the second episode on the Wednesday. And then they stopped.
Oh, no.
They never showed the other 5 episodes that had previously been shot, wow, edited, dubbed, and never went out.
What's it
called? They were so... It is called Hardwick House.
Hardwick House.
They were so confident that before they'd shown anything, they'd already commissioned Series 2. And, yeah, and nobody... and so we went from... 2 weeks prior to it, you know, it's on the front of every single paper. This is the big new show. To it went out. To it bombed. To public outcry. To we're not showing the rest of it. To a rumour that ITV had insisted that all VHSs of it were destroyed. So we'd gone from biggest sitcom of the year to this is actually going to damage the nation if it goes out.
Why? What was so bad about it? What was it? Was it set in a school? Was it Hardwick House?
It's set in a school called Hardwick House. The title is an innuendo.
Yes.
But let's be fair, sort of an 18th century restoration comedy innuendo.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Highbrow.
Yeah, well, yes. and it was, yeah, as I say, it was sort of St. Trinian's meets the Young Ones. And the reason it failed was because the production team, and I kind of love this, and I wish we could make TV like this now. Mm. The production team, the writers, the directors, and everyone thought they were making the Young Ones and were trying to make the Young Ones. That was very much their template. It was something, yeah, that was very big, broad slapstick. In the first episode, there is the school bully holding a child by its ankles over a stairwell, and gets distracted, lets go, and the child plummets to, I suppose, his death. But we never know. It's sort of Tom and Jerry humour. Yeah, yeah. And the ITV network decided to put it out at 8:30 in the evening in the kind of upper hand my family slot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it seems like no one ever watched the show to realise that's not what had been recorded. So you have Pam Ferris plays a kind of... They're all archetypes. So you've, yeah, got the militant feminist who's always trying to organise demonstrations and hates all the other teachers. You've got the pederast, or dare we say paedophile, teacher. It's mainly based around the teachers. And you've got the PE teacher, the exchange teacher. The headmaster's a drunk who sort of hides away in his office. It's kind of fits all the archetypes.
Yeah.
But no one... when they watch it, apparently it scared children, and children refused to go to school because they were scared by it. You can imagine families sort of sitting down and seeing school bullies actually literally killing children.
Wow.
and teachers coming on to children. And it was a kind of, it should have gone out in a different slot.
And you saw, you've seen all the episodes.
I've seen all the episodes,
how?
Yes.
Is this some sort of hazing you had to go through to get into a particular production company?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's what
EastEnders
happened.
Induction, you have to watch these and then never make anything like this ever.
Well, no, you see, I'm very fond of the show because it's specific. This show actually changed my life because I changed schools because of this show.
What?
So it was shot in, it was set in London,
right,
I'm told, although I don't think there's any reference to London. But it was shot in Nottingham, and I'm from Nottingham.
Right.
And, a little bit of trivia for you. Ed Miliband's wife, Justine, yes, Miliband, appears in it as a child.
Wow.
As does the actor who goes on to play Poe in the Teletubbies.
Amazing.
I'm just going to give you those little facts.
This is great. I love it. Already I love it. And then Ed Miliband's wife is in it and it's just gone,
yeah,
up a,
yeah,
level.
Just, yeah, exactly. So my mum, who then went to work in television, was running a drama group in Nottingham,
right,
who supplied all of the children as the supporting artists.
Sorry, supplying the children just sounds wrong. When, yeah, you put the content of the show.
Just your mum there with a fag end at her mouth. Do you want some kids? I'm getting some kids.
You've met my mum.
Yes.
We need to drop about 20 off banisters this week.
They did get through a lot. So she supplied a lot of the children for the show.
Okay, good.
Now I'm hearing that sentence.
Yeah.
And so because of that, my parents had all the VHSs, so I watched it before it went out.
Amazing.
And really irritatingly, just in one of their moves when people didn't have VHSs, they got rid of them, which I feel very upset about.
It'd be worth millions now.
Yeah, well, John Stroud, the director, also kept his. There are, and I think they are archived somewhere, but it's never been released. It did go out, I think, in the end in Canada and possibly France.
The whole series.
Like that. The whole series. Wow. But I think I've recently learned, I think there's a couple of places it did rumour to have gone out later on. So the school that it was filmed in what was essentially an empty Catholic school where the school had sold off and moved out.
Yeah.
But in about two classrooms was a little Steiner primary school. And my mum was looking to move my school. My mum and dad were looking to move me to a different school. And so that she sort of wandered in one day, having supplied her children, and said, "Oh, you have a school here." And I went to join that school.
Wow.
So I sort of owe Hardwick House quite a lot. So I've seen them all. And I think I know. Well, I don't know what... I know that somebody has watched all the episodes and has put them all online... and description of them all, so I know that this is now out there in the public domain, and I believe this is one of the reasons they didn't show them, is in a later, I think in episode 6, or maybe the last episode, they put on a school play, the Passion Plays, and crucify a teacher.
That's so good! That's so good!
And I think that's the point when, somewhere along the lines, the commissioners went, we should probably watch this, because it's getting quite a lot of flack, and they watched it and went, yeah, we probably can't show any more of this now, can we? And I think that's why it didn't go out from then
ahead on. Ahead of its time.
Ahead of it. I have to say, it's very much teachers.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, as in, it's a school sitcom around the teachers.
Yeah.
But the... and not really around the kids. And it's sort of about the fact that teachers are a load of layabouts.
Yeah.
It's slightly... The other thing... I mean, it went out entirely the wrong slot. The other thing that really made it... that really stopped it working was The Young Ones is filmed in front of a live audience. It's clearly a studio set.
Yeah.
It has band playing. And so that kind of anarchic, slapstick... comedy is clearly very fictional, whereas when you film something on location with real kids and things like that, there's a kind of genre mix up with it.
It's
weird. It sounds like if they made the school that the Trunchbull runs in Matilda but then made it as a documentary rather than as a
exactly that. Exactly that. You can watch the first two episodes on YouTube. Someone beautifully has uploaded them.
Oh, amazing. I know what I'm doing this afternoon. Yeah.
I would love to live in a world where we could still make television like that, where you can go out, you're given an enormous amount of money, and you go out and you make something, and only after it's put on television does anyone watch it and go, no, that's not what we wanted.
Yes.
It's sort of, I think that's that sort of living or dying by your sword is sort of missed now, where things are kind of edited to death before they to production, where you literally are risking the first people to see it appear to be the audience.
It's a classic thing. I know I've listened to various interviews with various members of the Python team who've just said, we wouldn't get made nowadays because, firstly, all of the Python TV shows are really patchy, but the first series was dog shit, and it was, I believe, Sir David Attenborough who went, no, give him a second one, because he was the commissioner at the time.
Cool.
All right, so your suggestion is the 1980s child-killing, pederastic, Christ-killing clusterfuck that was Hardwick House.
Beat that.
Yeah, all right.
3 stars, Radio Times.
I will do. A couple of very quick honourable mentions to begin with. Far and away the worst Christmas special I've ever watched, which was The Royal Bodyguard, which was David Jason playing a former Special Forces bodyguard, that was what he did in his youth. And now, as 71-year-old David Jason, he is the Queen's personal bodyguard. And it was basically written predicated on the idea that David Jason was a physical comedy genius in the style of Peter Sellers, whereas actually the only piece of physical comedy he's ever done correctly is falling through a bar. Yeah. That's it. It is painful to watch. It made me long for awkward Christmas meals with racist relatives.
It's always, you can always tell when someone's gone, this is a funny idea, and then you go, no, it's not really a funny idea for a series. It might be funny for an episode. Have you seen Come Back, Mrs. Noah?
No. Oh, I read about it.
Come Back, Mrs. Noah's brilliant. It's Molly Sugden gets blasted into space and they had the British space program have to try and retrieve her. Molly Sugden from Are You Being Served? Mrs. Slocum from Are You Being Served?
If only people could see my face.
Yeah. You look like you've glazed over at the sheer thought of it. Also, set in the year 2050, she wins a prize to go on board the spaceship and it accidentally blasts off with her on board it. It's written by Jeremy Lloyd and David Croft, who wrote Are You Being Served? Now, like big comedy writers. Ian Lavender, who's Pike in Dad's Army, is in it.
Who is now back in EastEnders. I directed his come back into the show.
Yeah.
Oh. What a legend.
Yeah, a total legend. Say,
what an absolute legend.
I'm so glad. He looks like a man who is just pure as the driven snow and an absolute delight.
Yes.
I will not dispute that.
I mean, good. You should ask him about his time on Come Back into the Show.
Well,
the majority of the comedy seems to be, oh look, she's so Yorkshire, but in space.
Yorkshire in space.
Yeah, and the thing is, every episode.
Does she have a pussy with her?
Oh, sadly, no. No, she has a handbag and is always drinking tea. And the clip I've seen is Ian Lavender with his head stuck in her bosoms. So, I mean, that's.
Do ask him about that.
While in space. Every joke in this is sort of ended by. While in space.
There has been a disappointing lack of Mrs. Slocum memes being sent to the President of the United States
this is
recently.
Very true, yeah.
I keep going back to Friends, but because it is probably the most successful sitcom of all time, whatever you think of it,
yep.
It's basically, here's a coffee shop, here are 620-somethings, the end, which kind of gives you quite a few places to go, but not much to start with.
Yeah.
But it does leave you open to people coming in and out of the coffee shop, for example.
Yeah, whereas in space.
We've blasted a Yorkshire woman into space, leaves very few options for guest appearances.
Yeah.
Very briefly, and there's going to be no argument about this, and it's not going to be my selection, but a runner-up to whatever any of us say is Mrs. Brown's Boys.
I thought you were going to say that.
And people might go, oh, Ben, but it's really popular. So was the Spice Girls' first album and the Bible. That doesn't mean they're any good.
But there's something terrifying about Mrs. Brown's Boys. Have you ever watched a full episode?
Yes.
I have, yeah.
When I did, I started watching the next episode. And the next one. There's some subliminal message that doesn't allow you to change the television over.
But it's got that same... The thing about Mrs. Brown's Boys... success. It has this same iceberg speed crushing inevitability as Brexit and Trump did.
We can possibly trace all of our political woes back to Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Fucking Brendan Carroll. If I had a gun and a time machine, I'd be going back to Brendan O'Carroll. I chatted on a previous podcast, not this one, a different one. Me and a friend were lucky enough to interview Ross Noble. Mm. And it's like, what's lovely about Ross is a real student of comedy, like real comedy nerd. And he loathes Mrs. Brown's Boys because he says, regardless of any of the bullshit fourth wall breaking and the lowest common denominator, half the jokes are stolen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're stolen from stuff in the 50s and 60s, so people don't notice. And audiences might not care, but as a professional comedian, it is infuriating.
Well, someone on the BBC went to see it because they had a night.
Yeah, they were doing live shows and things.
Yeah, and went, and looked at the audience and went, this is insane, we have to have this.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've talked about that.
You've purged yourself. I could, from the minute we decided to do this episode, I was like, Ben just needs to get some of the Mrs. Brown bile out.
So, I hate it so much. But, right, very quickly, there's an American sitcom in the 70s called Holmes and Yo-Yo, where a nominal 1970s Sherlock Holmes gets an android sidekick called Yo-Yo.
Who is...
bafflingly obsessed with a desire to get his own genitalia. In the same way that Pinocchio wants to be a real boy, this guy wants
a real car.
Yeah, exactly. Yo-Yo will often malfunction. Some of his malfunctions include spinning uncontrollably when he's near a garage door. being attracted to magnets. Whenever people fire bullets at him, he starts dancing.
And he's the opposite of Yosemite Sam.
Yeah,
when he's firing bullets, he has to dance.
He picks up Swedish radio channels, and then for no good reason, he will occasionally malfunction and just keep repeating the phrase "the Bunko Squad, the Bunko Squad, the Bunko Squad."
My favourite of those is the garage doors one, because the others you can sort of see a logic behind them. The, you know, like it's a metal robot, you can see how they, but the idea that you have a plot device, which means that whenever he goes past a garage door, which is potentially quite regular,
we've got to investigate a crime in suburban America.
Yeah. Well, it's like going back to improv. It's like endowing yourself with something at the beginning of a scene and going, oh man, I wish I had endowed myself to do Bollywood dancing.
I'm allergic to the floor.
One of the most ill-advised British sitcoms of all time that got canned after one episode was Heil, Honey, I'm Home. This was an episode that posited what would happen if Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun lived together and their next-door neighbours were Jewish.
Called the Goldensteins.
The Goldensteins, yeah. And it's basically... The thing is, you can make amazing comedy capital out of Hitler. Like, the producers is obviously very, very good. Yep. Spike Milligan wrote some brilliant stuff about Hitler.
Yep.
But it's just... The thing that I love about this is that it was screened directly after an episode of Dad's Army.
Yeah.
And the continuity announcer said, well, unless Arthur Lowe defeats him, it's the man himself coming up next.
And his dad Tom is the warm-up boy.
Yeah, it was on Galaxy, which was sort of owned by BSkyB, or what became BSkyB, I think. And their big Saturday night sitcom bonanza.
It was atrocious. And it ended, the single episode ended with Arnie Goldenstein and Eva being involved in a conga line.
Yes.
And halfway through the episode, Neville Chamberlain turns up. Yeah. Ding dong, who's that? It's Neville! whilst Hitler hides the Peace in Our Time piece of paper in the icebox.
Yeah. Hitler says things like, you invade one country, everyone's on your back.
Pre-war or post-war?
It's 1938, because it's all about his plans to do...
So it's before he kills millions of people.
I think the remaining series was meant to be him trying to find ways to kill... The neighbour, he finds the neighbours immensely annoying, and so decides to try and find ways of killing them.
Oh, God. It sounds like a Family Guy cutaway sketch that took on a life of its own and couldn't be killed. But that's... It's fucking awful. But it's not as amusingly disastrous as... not one of my choices. Well, my choice will come to in a second. Brief shout out for a terrible animated sitcom called Father of the Pride.
Oh.
Now, Father
of... Lion King meets...
Oh, no. This is the untold story of Siegfried and Roy's lions and tigers.
I love it.
And the circus that surrounds it. The main lion is called Larry. It is voiced by John Goodman, obviously.
Is that the one that tried to kill either Siegfried or Roy?
Funny you should mention that. Because...
Please tell me that's the first episode.
No.
He's on trial.
Larry the lion, for the crimes that you have committed.
Wait for me.
I will. They sort of workshopped it and started putting it together in the early 21st century. Just before it was released in 2004, Roy was attacked by one of the lions and they had to can it. But my selection for the worst TV comedy of all time, I've gone to this trope before about the ones you love hurt you the most. My great comedy hero is Spike Milligan.
Yes.
I adore him. The Goon Show was and is probably the greatest achievement in British comedy.
In Britain, full stop.
In Britain, full stop. Admittedly, written by an Irishman.
Shakespeare was Irish, as you know, guys.
Of course you
were.
there's the great story of Spike Milligan's having dinner somewhere, and a guy goes up and goes, Mr. Milligan, I'd just like to say that you are, without a shadow of a doubt, the greatest living Brit. And he just goes, I'm Irish, you cunt. So this... sitcom, it only went aired for one episode. It was called The Melting Pot.
Yeah.
And it's written in 1975, and it's based on a guy. Spike Milligan plays a guy called Mr. Van Gogh, and Mr. Van Gogh is Pakistani, got it right. And he turns up on the shores of Dover with John Bird, as in from Bird and Fortune, brilliant improvisational actor, and they are a pair of illegal Asian immigrants who are trying to get to this mystical part of London called The Melting Pot.
Yeah.
It's basically a horrible, nasty play on multiculturalism.
Yeah, it's awful, browning off.
The problem is this, I will defend a lot of the racial humour on The Goon Show because I genuinely think a lot of it is Spike looking at the giant human carnival and he will take the piss out of everyone. But this, it's badly written. Like, the lovely thing with Milligan is it should have this zip and this zing and this absurdism, and it's acted like a bad sixth form sketch. the first scene when they come to London, they're looking at all these various takeaway restaurants and just going, oh, this is amazing. And then they see another sign that says fresh Indian meat. They go, whoa, don't go in there. And they and then they go into a place that...
also, a really bizarre sign. I don't think... Maybe it was a common sign to see fresh Indian meat. I don't think I've ever seen that sign around.
You're just going to the wrong brothels. but they go into a place, they see hamburgers, but it's actually Hamburgers the Bookmakers. And before they go in, Spike says to John Bird, don't order curry, big giveaway. Just the jokes... It's like watching Lionel Messi doing keepy uppies when he's in his 60s and he's overweight and he's smoking a fag and mainlining heroin.
Yeah.
And then the point at which I turned off was the point at which they're in some sort of guest house and they're with a guy, he's washing his face, you think he's black, but he's not, and he's washed the black off. And all the way through, there's this terrible, vague sitar soundtrack, as though they decided to hire Ravi Shankar and thought better of it later on. I mean, I've not mentioned the obvious sexism, but, Spike was a big fan of breasts, and in many ways, who isn't? And yes, they can jiggle, yes, they can be funny, but give me a bit more, Spike. But it's got that, it's got blacking up, it's got horrendous racism, really backwards politics, terrible jokes, an awful soundtrack, and it got cancelled after one show.
Just on that point, can I mention Turn On, which was an ABC variety show in 1969, which had big, like, very edgy sexual political humour, counterculture stuff. And one station in Cleveland didn't return to it after the first commercial break of the first episode. So it was cancelled before the first episode had even finished.
Oh my god, that's like amazing. That's like football managers who get sacked within 6 hours because new owners take over.
But I'm just thinking the practicality of the fact that you're sitting there watching it. And it's in the evening, so quite higher powered people within your channel won't be there, within your network. And then... you've got, so once, so you're sitting at home, I suppose they must be sitting at home and watching it, and then they have to phone up the network and say, take it off at the next commercial break. Yeah. And they have to decide something else to put on instead. I mean, that is extraordinary.
Well, it was one of the local, because of syndication in America, local networks. So I guess they just went, here's the weather for the next half hour.
I now have to decide which it will be, whether it is Barry's baffling My Mother the Car, involving a 1950s Battle of the Sexes and a reincarnated mother in a car.
Yeah. Okay, can I just say with that one, I want to get hold of the scripts and stage it as a fringe show without anyone knowing it's a joke.
Can you please do it with the mum being a mum rather than a car?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do the episode where they're getting drunk on antifreeze.
Yeah, we'll get the scripts and we'll hide the chickens.
Spirit the fringe. Ready to go. Or it's Tom's Hardwick House, which I think it's certainly the greatest fall from grace.
Yes.
From, a real stellar cast. Or we've got my hero Spike ruining everything. This is a really hard choice, James.
It's a really wide variety, isn't it?
It's a real wide variety, because me and Tom are very much in the tasteless and awful and being let down by talented people.
And what's funny about Hardwick House is that line between success and failure is so slight.
Yeah.
It could have been so brilliant had a few things worked in its favour that didn't work in its favour.
Put it on at 10 o'clock.
Put it on at 10 o'clock, set it in the studio, have a few less characters, be clearer what the style is, that kind of thing. And just tiny tweaks, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, and yours, the thing is, I'm finding it very hard to pick yours, Barry, because I really want to watch it.
I've got to send you the links. You can watch a couple of episodes this afternoon.
I just don't think it's the worst sitcom of all time.
I think it might be vying for the best.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's really hard. And again, I'm finding it hard to pick yours because it's a really deeply upsetting story.
Yes.
And weirdly, like particularly the last plot line where they have a Passion of the Christ of the Teachers, that just sounds like a League of Gentlemen plot line.
It is going towards a sort of League of, 20 years before League of Gentlemen, just missing the boat.
And I'm finding it quite hard to pick mine as well, because...
Because it's Spike Milligan.
Yeah. And there's, it is loathsome politically in every way, but I sort of feel that I'm glad The Melting Pot was made as a reminder of a place that we should not go to in comedy.
Yeah.
And so because of that, I'm going to pick Mrs. Brown's Boys. Because I think we can all get on board with that, can't we, gents?
Oh, the old bait and switch.
Yeah. Now, before we go, we've got to have the world's worst news. This news comes from India, that the Indian Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, has removed 86% of the entire currency from the economy.
What?
So all of the 5,000 rupee notes and 10,000 rupee notes, which are basically our 5 and 10 pound notes, have been removed to try and prevent corruption and bribery and basically, he has ruined the Indian economy in one fell swoop.
I don't feel you should be saying this when there's a chance, a slim chance, that Donald Trump might be listening.
He could do the same thing.
Yes. That's a good idea.
Let's remove all the nominations below $100 bills.
Yeah, and then they're going to all get reprinted with pictures of Donald Trump on them. Yeah, look at that. Got a stack of Trumps and then another stack of Trumps. And then, oh, can I pay you in some Trumps?
My friend here, Mr. Trump, might have something to say about that.
Oh, but I can just... That's a lovely sketch.
Wrong.
To have a Trump note being put into a call girl's garter belt and just the picture smiling on the note. So, before we pop off, Tom, where can people find you and what can they find you doing there?
Well, I'm about to do some more EastEnders, so you can watch those when they come up. I'm on Twitter, at Mr. Thomas Hescott. And you can find me in my home watching reruns of Friends.
Cracking stuff.
Yeah, if you arrange to have coffee with them, expect them half an hour later than you arranged. Because you have to wait for the episode to finish.
I was thinking, am I always letting you down my timing? I thought that was a really passive-aggressive way to
No, it's just... It's just your friend's habit.
Yeah, oh,
this
yeah,
is an intervention. Yeah. That's what he's going to say.
Right, well, we're off to watch a marathon of Hail Honey, I'm Home, The Melting Pot, and all of Mrs. Brown's Boys. Yeah. Until next time, bye bye.
Thanks for listening.
Justice.
All of that research that myself and Tom did, completely undercut by Ben just getting a dig in at Mrs. Brown's Boys there at the end.
Your country and culture has produced many great writers and artists that you should be very, very proud of. Like Joyce and Milligan and Wilde cannot weigh out the negative yang of Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Well, there's lots of wonderful viewing material for you guys in there. If you don't like Mrs. Brown's Boys, maybe you like My Mother the Car as well. Please do watch it on YouTube. It is genuinely one of the funniest, terrible things I've ever watched. And thank you again to Tom for doing that. You can check out his work. He's directing episodes of EastEnders here and there. Dip in and you'll see just what a talented man he is. And he's also on Twitter, as I think he said, at Mr. Thomas Hescott. As are we.
Yes, we are. We're at Worst Foot. You can also find us on Facebook. Direct your attention to our iTunes or Stitcher page. Leave us a cheeky little review. That'd be nice.
Another thing to say is we have an email address, worstforwardpodcast@gmail.com. One thing we'd love you guys to do is to drop us an email if you have been listening to us on, say, SoundCloud and you have a podcast carrier or host that you use that we're not listed on. Let us know, because we're finding some here and there that people can't find us on, and we'll add ourselves to that so that we are even more convenient for your oral pleasure.
If you know of someone, particularly someone who's not a stand-up comedian, who you think would be a belting guest, email in and let us know. Mm-hmm. And also, if you go, do you know what, I really want to hear about the world's worst elephants, or the world's worst...
Yeah, because those guys need a kicking. Bloody edge of extinction, super mammals.
Elephants have been charismatic megafauna for too long. They need taken down a peg or two. But yeah, if you think of a subject that we should absolutely talk about, email in and let us know.
Our guest next week is, oh my God, what a fun episode this was, is the excellent Lynn Ruth Miller. She is the oldest working stand-up on the circuit. Ben's gigged her once or twice. Mm-hmm. And she is in her 80s, and she decided to take us down memory lane on a few of the world's worst dates. This has been one of the hardest episodes to edit because we went off on so many tangents, because she is just a fount of knowledge and terrible anecdote.
She's also a filthy grandma.
She is a filthy, filthy grandma. And we had an absolute brilliant time hosting her here. So tune in for that, and we'll see you next week.